want to remain in that location through the wintertime, we're proceeding on schedule to have the armory and the churches open. The churches open early in the year. They're already open, but the armory open December 3rd. We're working with the city and others to see what resources we can come up with, and if anyone is to be on the property after December 3, liability, good judgment, and common sense requires that they be in some way staffed, that there be some responsibility that CCH and or the city and or the homeless shelter would take for monitoring and providing some kind of supervision. So if that can all be worked out financially and in terms of personnel, then I think that that we're in a position to take, I don't want to make promises that I can't make good on, and I don't like to be put in a position of having anyone assume that I'm either stonewalling on one side or on the other hand that I'm making representations that I can't make good on. So I'm giving you the best information that I can, given all the variables. And that is that we will take seriously, we have taken seriously, and continue to take seriously, the possibility of having open-air shelter, along with all of our other programs that we have consistently had over the years and will have in full measure this year, beyond December 3. But that's a totally informal statement. And it's an acknowledgement that we are taking, we have taken seriously, will continue to take seriously, the representations that have been made on behalf of people living at 111 Coral Street. We will also continue to work. There is a process that the city, that the mayor has initiated. Councilperson Scott Kennedy and Councilperson Celia Scott have been participating in that process for seeking vigilantly and responsibly alternate sites for open-air shelter beyond the time that whatever time the shelter is closed, and for anyone to represent that that is not possible, that it's in any way a sham or anything else, or that there is not a process, is simply inaccurate and serves no good purpose. I've attended a number of meetings in that regard. The mayor has had directed and had response immediately from the planning department to locate a variety of alternate locations. I've personally gone to the owners of several of those locations, and it's simply not possible for any individual to either make a realistic suggestion that about what might be done with someone else's land, whether it's the churches or whether it's the cities or whether it belongs to a private party or a nonprofit organization or is leased by goodwill or anything else. Those conversations have to be taken seriously, have to be processed through their boards, through and the goodwill of all involved has to be assumed, as well as the urgency of the people on whose behalf we're all here and working, and that is the people who have no alternative or extremely few alternatives. So we are continuing to pursue that, have and will.
And that was Daryl Darling, Community House Director, speaking on November 21st at the Duck Pond Negotiation Session, convened by Brimstone Barbara Riverwoman, as I call her, community activist, concerned citizen, and a Quaker who has been deeply involving herself in these issues for the last month and a half. Note in that statement, and by the way, if you want to call in and comment on that statement, do give a call to Free Radio Santa Cruz at 427-3772. Our phone lines are open, and we are waiting for your calls. My comments on that statement are, one, it's a hopeful statement in terms of the suggestion that the campground will be kept open or might be kept open throughout the winter for those who need to stay there. Less hopeful, however, is Daryl's obfuscation, as I consider it to be, around the issue of an alternate site. There has indeed been a City Council alternate site committee looking for a place to move the open-air shelter, the current campground, in the spring when the armory lets out on March 15th, and there is no armory winter shelter, and there presumably will be anywhere from 100 to 200 people needing shelter, if not more, who will need a place to pitch a tent or lay down a sleeping bag. The reality has been that though that open-air shelter has been looking for different places and has indeed gone to the planning department and gotten their help, and Daryl has indeed attended those meetings, as have I, the result of those meetings, as almost any committee member who's not a member of the City Council or Daryl Darling will tell you, has been zero, zilch, nothing, no sites. They've met many possible sites. We've gone to this site, we've gone to that site, we checked the Pioneer House site, we checked the Hardy West Park site, we checked the site up by the church on the hill, near behind the St. Francis Soup Kitchen, or actually it's a little bit down from that. We've checked De La Viega sites. I haven't, but Barbara Riverwoman has. And thus far, the problems, and this, of course, is the point on which Daryl is, in my mind, and the Citizens Committee and the City Council is most to be criticized, not ask the obvious question, why not find a site for the trailers? The community house project of 10 trailers for 48 people that they intend to displace 200 people with in March, why not find an alternate site for those trailers rather than look for an alternate site for a campground for 100 to 200 people that they are not going to find in all likelihood in terms of the community problems involved? The reason the site at Highway 1 and River Street has evolved has been because it's isolated, it's really undesirable for residential purposes, it's really a miserable place to be, frankly. It's noisy and loud during the day, you've got fumes from the highway, you've got dust from the cement factory. When the City Council criticizes that site as being an unhealthy and unpleasant area, or actually, let's say, certainly in the winter, it turns into, according to Karen Gelatin, and certain this is true, a mud pile. It's not, it certainly isn't a rosy place. But the fact is, it's the only place they found, and it's the only open-air shelter in California that exists at the current time. Not to say that it would serve California, not at all. It serves the people of Santa Cruz and those who come to Santa Cruz. And this myth I hear that is iterated again and again. In any case, I continue to hear it, that this is a sort of a magnet effect. People are coming to stay in this wonderful mud hole, or this wonderful, overcrowded, dusty, musty, loud place where, you know, yeah, you got your drunks there, you got your noise, you got your bullies, you know, you got all that stuff there, no question about it. But you also have people who have no other place to stay, and they need a place to stay, and they're willing to work throughout the winter to weatherize that place and make it a usable place, and to keep the community such as it is, such as they have together, those who want to stay there during the winter, if only the Citizens Committee will not block it. And it begins to appear that the Citizens Committee won't block it. But again, my criticism was the statements of Daryl Darling indicating that somehow there's a good faith search for another site for the open-air shelter. Yeah, there is a pro forma search going on, and it's good faith. I don't think these people are lying to us. They just know, or they should know, that there isn't at the moment any other site, and they should also be looking for sites for the trailers. But they're unwilling to put any pressure on their pals in the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, partially because the person who's leading the subcommittee, Celia Scott, is on the board of directors of the Citizens Committee for the Homeless. I mean, let's get real here, folks. Now, Celia didn't like it when I brought that up. She got so upset she proposed mediation with me. Well, Celia, we have no problems talking to each other. I've got no difficulty talking with you. But we have to realize the realities of this when a conflict of interest comes up. No, her membership on the Citizens Committee is not per se a conflict of interest, but when it becomes obvious, she is steering steering the meetings away from any consideration of moving the trailers or criticizing the Citizens Committee or putting pressure on the Citizens Committee, then it is obvious and must be faced that there is a conflict of interest there. By the way, that subcommittee meets in early December. If you're interested in knowing when and where, give a call to City Council at 429-3550. That's the City Council 24-hour message line. You'll catch staff there during the day, and I don't mean, you'll probably catch an infection of one sort or another, but you'll catch staff members of City Council who will be able to give you that information. I find the committee so irrelevant that I actually don't remember the date, but of course I'll probably be attending their meeting. I hate meetings, I'll tell you. They're just endless and useless in the case of this open-air shelter subcommittee, at least have been up to now. And again, maybe there's a breakthrough in the offing. You know, that's my hope. But in the event that there is no breakthrough, I want to remind all of you who are concerned with this issue. Whoops, I see an incoming phone call. Hang on. Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Yes. We're talking about alternatives, and I've called you once before. I live in a tent, and I'm homeless, so to speak, but I enjoy being out of the box and in the air.
Right. Can you speak up a little bit? We have bad... I can hear you, but I'm afraid that the folks at home may not be able to hear you as much as I am.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure. What we think we have to do is find alternatives, and we have available the state park.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the state park is public land,
right?
And as citizens of America, we should have the right to put our bodies on the land that we're supposed to have sovereignty over.
I agree.
So all we have to do is, in goodwill, bring up the issue of the sovereignty of our human dignity, that we have a right to place our body on the earth, which is given by the Creator, which is the supreme lawgiver to us all.
Mm-hmm.
So, therefore, we have the freedom to go to the state park, which is public land, and put our bodies...
You're talking about Henry Cowell State Park?
I'm talking about Henry Cowell, exactly.
Right.
Especially in the wintertime, where it's not very, so to speak, appetizing for tourists.
Right.
Now, that's land that should be used. See, if the churches don't have the benevolence to open up their hearts and their money, because there is money in the church system, isn't they're not poverty-stricken.
Mm.
The key is, with the money, the benevolence is to show that with the money, we can do great things. And in other words, instead of hoarding it like Bill Gates, $40 billion worth of power,
mm-hmm.
The idea is to show through example that by sharing the wealth, we raise the dignity of everyone.
I agree. Shall I tell you, however, what I think will be likely to happen if people did do that?
Tell me, please.
Well, Henry Cowell actually was touted as a solution, or at least a partial solution, for people back in the earthquake when there was an even greater need for shelter. And indeed, I guess there was some sheltering happening up there. But the state park system, as you may know, I believe this is true of the state park system, it's either the state or the federal, or maybe both, they have tightened up on their restrictions. So you can only stay, I think, a total of 2 weeks per year, and maybe it's 7 days at a time in a campsite. And this, I think, is, you know, you might say it's designed to spread the wealth around in terms of the days and sites available, but my sense was that it really is an attempt to dislodge poor people from state parks when they're using them for residency purposes.
Right.
Now, I'm not saying this couldn't be changed, but that is perhaps some of the bureaucratic stuff you face, and I'd love to have you investigate this issue if you want to actually phone in, find out what the regulations are.
I would love to, I would find that out for sure. I was going to mention that... I could see during the peak season, like say July 4th, if there was a lot of homeless people, so to speak, taking up all the most of the available sites, that the state park system may, you know, be a little flustered with the...
Which actually isn't usually the case, because the people with plastic reserve those things months in advance anyway.
Uh-huh. Well, I could see that in the time of the winter, where there's not much of a tourist demand.
No, you're right. It's completely reasonable. I mean, there. You know, I don't think any of our listeners would have any dispute with you, and if they do, I'd like to hear them call in. But what I'd like to get from you, if you, what's your first name?
Paul.
Hey, Paul.
Hi.
Is the specifics from the state, when you call up and actually ask, what are the regulations about staying on this land, what are the costs, and if you can get back to me at the next show with these specifics, we'll get a, you know, an interesting view of what kind of resources are actually available and which way the American, well, the park system is going, the state park system here.
Okay.
Is there more you want to say on this issue?
Well, basically, I'd like to say I appreciate the fact that you take the time every week to bring up these issues and awaken people to such a crucial basic right that really opens the whole facade, so to speak, the emperor's clothes of democracy to viewing, because in reality, human beings are not dogs. Human beings are supposed to be dignified spiritual beings. Not that dogs have no sense of spirituality, I guess, in their being, but I think human beings, so to speak, deserve more than a parking space.
That's for sure. And I guess another thing you might find of interest is if you go to City Council tomorrow night or tomorrow afternoon at 3:30 when they're having their meeting on the emergency shelter lifting of the regulations, and that's down on right across from the main public library, in case you don't know where it is, there is a period of oral communications, or at least there will be a public comment section for that particular part of the agenda. You'll find that, you know, there are obviously other parks, like there's city parks, you know, which supposedly they're considering looking for an open-air shelter for. And then, of course, there's the obvious Pogonip, where they have acres and acres and acres of land up there, which you'd think they could set aside a half acre for poor people.
Harvey West.
But the reality has been, when this was mentioned, not Harvey West, but the Pogonip, Celia Scott, who was elected a lot on an environmental platform, and I've got no problem with that. She immediately ruled it out, saying, "Oh no, there's a problem with sanitation and a problem with drainage, and there's a problem with polluting the river." The Pogonip was originally proposed back in 1985 when Calamity Jane Immler, the activist whose hunger strike established this committee for Citizens Committee for the Homeless, and also the first Poor and Rainy Night Shelter, Cold and Rainy Night Shelter for poor people, the Cedar Street Shelter downtown, which is near where the Cumbwa Jazz Center is, and lasted for one season. Pogonip, her main concern was for a low-income campground, and we actually now have that through a combination of protest, campers simply peacefully moving in and refusing to leave, and some diplomatic negotiations between bureaucrats that has happened over the years. So, but I'm afraid that your very reasonable suggestion about the parks, when you look at it on the city level, you see they want to keep all the best land for people in houses to walk their dogs on, you know, or wander through, rather than concern themselves with the living needs of everybody else.
Exactly. And I obviously, if people come from other parts of the world, in other parts of the state, whatever, to Santa Cruz, and they happen to be no income, low income, and no place to live, etc., it's obvious you don't necessarily have to, wheel out the royal copper to everybody that comes in that's just checking out Santa Cruz for whatever reason. But at the same time, if there is open space at a state park, I think people have a right and have a place to sleep feeling like they have to break a law.
Right, and that's what happens here in Santa Cruz under the city's 6.36 sleeping ban. After 11 o'clock at night, you are illegal. You sleep outside or in your vehicle.
Right. I'd like to end it here because I appreciate your show, and I know you have a lot to do.
And please do check out that stuff and get back to us either on Friday, when I'll have the show will resume between 10 and 12, or next Monday.
Okay, thank you, Robert.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm glad we're getting some call-ins. Thank you, Paul. And the lines are open for those of you who want to do some calling in. We do have an interview coming up with Catnip Kate Wells at 11 o'clock on a number of issues. She's kind of rush in and rush out. She has a busy schedule. Kate Wells worked with Grinning Ray Grunike, the attorney I mentioned before, on numerous homeless cases over the years, and she's still got a very soft heart. I know she's getting buried under mortgage problems and all kinds of personal difficulties financially, and needs financial support. We should really have a Kate Wells benefit. That's what we need here. We need an attorney who's full-time working for civil rights for the poor. Legal aid is a real joke around this issue on most issues. I've time and time again approached them, or the ACLU, on issues of the sleeping ban, and nothing. You know, they are... I get the door on that one, even though I can't even get a sensible response from them as to why they're refusing this. No doubt it's because of my personal reputation, perhaps? I don't know. Let's take a little break here, and actually we have a guest coming into the studio, even as I speak. No, he's not a guest, he's an anonymous figure. He's a sometime guest, he's the mailman, and what... Thank you. New York Times had a couple of interesting stories in the Sunday edition. One was a story, New Orleans considers anti-camping law to deter homeless. Here, let's see what they have to say here. New Orleans, November 25th. Like cities elsewhere, New Orleans is struggling with the problem of homelessness, trying to find ways to preserve the aura and ambiance of the city's historic French Quarter without trampling on the rights of the unfortunate. The approach of one city council member has resonated among a vocal contingent of residents and business people, but even she acknowledged that it has little chance of becoming law. The councilwoman, Peggy Wilson, one of two Republicans on the seven-member council, has proposed an ordinance to forbid the use of public parks, streets, parking lots, and other areas for camping or storing personal belongings. Does this sound familiar, folks? It's interesting how the New York Times begins this by saying this is some sort of without trampling on the rights of the unfortunate. Well, maybe there's more to the story. Let's read on. Obviously, restricting the right of people to sleep in public places and to have their to store their belongings, which is a code word for have their belongings with them, sitting on the ground next to them. And if police don't like them, they just tell them to leave or they confiscate their stuff, which is all the rage in San Francisco under the Matrix program, and has been done here in Santa Cruz, particularly at the beginning of the decade, 1990s, when police were going through bedding like there was no tomorrow. They would confiscate your sleeping bag if you were in a protest. They would confiscate your blankets. They would confiscate your shoes. I remember Jabberwocky J. Green, an ancient political activist. Well, it seems ancient now. He died in 1990. He came to town. He set up a vigil in front of the post office. It lasted 8.5 months. Some of you old-timers may remember it. They confiscated his shoes once. He had to come into court without any shoes, and he did so with without any kind of apology. Anyway, continuing this article from the New York Times, New Orleans considers anti-camping law to deter homeless. At least 42 cities nationwide have adopted tactics to reduce the visibility of the homeless. There we go. That's the key word. By conducting street sweeps, banning panhandling or other activities, or enforcing park closing laws or other ordinances that do not single out the homeless, but nonetheless affect them, said Rick Hertz, who monitors civil rights for the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty. Many measures have been challenged in the courts. Atlanta, the site of the 1996 Summer Olympics, has adopted several measures intended to move the homeless out of high-visibility areas, said Anita Beattie, executive director of Atlanta's Task Force for the Homeless and the president of the National Coalition for the Homeless based in Washington. Perhaps in the future we'll have some taped interviews with these people. I think it'll be interesting for us to see what's going on in other areas. More than 14,000 homeless people live in New Orleans based on 1994 statistics from the city-run medical clinic that serves this population. There are about 860 shelter beds in the city, said the clinic's director, Kathleen W. McCaffrey, and all are privately operated. Some shelters charge a fee for repeat visitors. The city is planning a homeless pavilion. Ah, here we go. An open space where street people can find a cot and a shower, according to Vincent Sylvan, executive assistant to Mayor Mark Morial. Mayor Morial opposes the anti-camping ordinance, said a spokeswoman, Michelle Moore. That's a twist. Although I must say that I think Catherine Byers, in private, has spoken against the camping ban, as has Scott Kennedy at different times. Of course, neither of them have the political courage, or you might say, the ovaries and the balls to stand up and actually lead this discussion in the direction it needs to go here in Santa Cruz. Continuing with New Orleans, however. Lee Tucker, a French Quarter artist who heads a community group, Friends of Jackson Square, said his organization supported Ms. Wilson's proposal as part of the solution. Her proposal, again, is a camping ban, or sleeping ban, actually, as well as apparently a possessions for the homeless ban. He said that while residents felt compassion for needy people, the focus should be on helping the homeless get off the streets rather than making it easy for them to stay, at least get the hell off our streets, right? And he said residents and business people have grown frustrated with a rowdy, youthful element. Does this sound like Mayor Mike Rotkin coming down the pike or what? Just because you are homeless doesn't mean you can disobey the laws or be respectful, he said. Mm-hmm. Yeah, respect our wealth, folks. Councilwoman Wilson said that there was adequate shelter space for those who truly needed it. This, again, has been the line of mayors in Santa Cruz, from Mayor Marty Wormhout, who's now our supervisor, even to the current mayor, Catherine Byers, who made such a ridiculous statement publicly about 3 weeks ago. And when I chastised her for it at the Duck Pond meeting, I think Duck Pond meeting number 2 it was, where we met to discuss the open-air shelter, she freely admitted that she was in error when she said there was adequate shelter. There is not adequate shelter. It's a joke and a lie and a farce to claim there is. And it also, it tends to strengthen anti-homeless vicious sentiment that gets people to into a kind of a vigilante mood when they don't like Lee Kornstrom or Mike Rotkin fashion, seeing people on the streets that are poor or that are deadheads or have guitars or that are sitting around, then, hey, they can come after them, they can beat them up, they can harass them, they can use the police to clear them out of town. It's a sad situation when such misstatements come from people in positions of high authority. And we're going to be seeing plenty of such misstatements, I'm afraid, from Mayor Mike Rotkin starting on Tuesday, if I'm not mistaken. And I sure hope I am, but frankly, experience is the best teacher here in this case. Let's hope for a conversion. Many people who sleep in public spaces have places to go if they are forced to, Ms. Wilson said. She also asserted that many homeless people simply balked at obeying rules at shelters. They don't like to be sober, she said. They don't like to make their beds up in the morning. So, see, these homeless people are just a bunch of unruly kids, a bunch of spoiled kids who, you know, put a little of the shoe leather on them, you know, whip them into shape and they'll be okay. This kind of mentality has no relation to reality, but let's press on. Among New Orleans homeless are young street dwellers, commonly referred to as gutter punks or grunge kids. Their critics say that they are not homeless, but merely rebellious, countercultural youth living on the streets of the French Quarter for the thrill of it. You'll hear the same thing about deadheads. So these are a bunch of rich kids. They got money to go to deadhead concerts. They're running all over the place. Most of the people with tie-dyes on that I've talked to in the last month did not look rich at all to me, I'll tell you frankly. And the misnomer deadheads, now we have a situation where the deadhead phenomenon is definitely kind of on hold because you don't have a Jerry Garcia. Many of these kids are from well-to-do families, said Councilman Troy Carter, a Democrat whose district includes the French Quarter. They choose to do this, so I don't categorize them as homeless. Let's remove the civil rights from all young people, right? It makes a lot of sense. That's what they're trying to do here in Santa Cruz County. On November 9th in the evening, the Board of Supervisors, on January 9th in the evening, the Board of Supervisors is going to meet and attempt to remove the civil liberties with a stroke of the pen of all people under 18. They will enact a curfew law, probably by a 4-1, maybe a 3-2 majority, unless we can get that swing vote back again. Even though there is no legal place for the overwhelming majority of people who are homeless to be, even though young people who are innocent are going to be forced to justify their behavior after 11 o'clock. They have to be going to and from sanctioned events and places. We are talking police state here, folks. Police state for the young. And anybody who looks under 18 are going to have to pull out ID to verify that they are who they are and their age is what it is. This is Santa Cruz County. This is your home county. This is your city that we're talking about here. Now, the Santa Cruz City, and here's a sly bit of hypocrisy in action, the city council bravely stood up against this curfew law, right? They postured and they said, oh, this is a violation of civil liberties. It's not needed, so forth and so on. Yes, quite right, quite true. This is the same city council that voted for downtown ordinances and civil liberties restrictions on poor people. Now, they removed the curfew section of this, actually, in 1994. There was going to be a Santa Cruz City curfew that was part of the downtown ordinances, and that section of the downtown ordinances, the ordinances make it illegal to sit down and panhandle and so forth, that was removed because they realized, in my opinion, I'm just guessing here, but hey, check out my guess and see if you think I'm right. They realized, do I see an incoming call? No, I don't. Please call in. If I've been missing you, call in 427-3772. The city council realized in 1994 when they were passing this anti-homeless, anti-poor set of laws that if they added to it with an anti-young set of laws, they would have real trouble on their hands. And indeed, the people who threw rocks through the windows on May 11th at Cathcart and Pacific after the police had shown up in riot gear and beaten up people earlier in the day there and created a mob scene by arresting people for innocent sitting were young people, very young people. They were teens and preteens almost. I don't know if they were preteens. I didn't see them, but these are secondhand reports I got. So it's a political move, folks. That's why Scott Kennedy and the council is so solicitous of our curfew rights in Santa Cruz City. I mean, I'm glad they are, but I don't really want to pat them on the back or commend them too much for it, because I see so much else wrong with what they're doing that I regard this as a play for liberal and university votes. And frankly, I don't want to see the votes of the university people. I don't want to see the votes of the liberals going to these guys and these women who have sold out the homeless and the poor. People like Jane Yokoyama, whom I call Jane Hokey Mama, who has been sitting on the council for nearly a decade now. She came into power with a claim, as I mentioned in my last show, that she would oppose the ticketing of people in vehicles without a complaint. A very, very mellow and mild reform. She was on the Human Rights Task Force. Well, when she got elected, along with Mo Reisch and Don Lane, she completely abandoned that position in 1988. And I could go on at length about this. But entering the studio is our guest of the day, the woman who is hard to pin down, but when you got her, you got her. Because this woman has got a heart of gold, or perhaps a heart of straw. Who could set fire to a heart of straw? She's been helping people right and left for the last decade and going into poverty because of it. Though she probably is richer than most of us at the moment, if you want to call it rich. It's Catnip Kate Wells I'm talking about. Say hello, Catnip.
Hey, how are you today?
Now move that chair closer.
Uh-oh.
You
got to
be
okay.
about a little bit. There you go.
That close? Am I that okay?
That's great.
Okay.
So you've been an attorney here in Santa Cruz for what? How long?
17 years.
Wow. You know, I want to kind of proceed chronologically. Have you been involved in civil rights for the poor throughout that period, or is this sort of a recent development?
No, this is something I've done from the beginning. I started out with a small task of suing the Pentagon for disabled Vietnam vets, which I spent my first, probably my first 10 years doing that until I ended up being the object of a lot of attention from the Pentagon and had my phones tapped and laser surveillance equipment reading the vibrations off the window in my office and tape recording every word that was said in my office. So,
do you have documentation on this stuff? Or is this your paranoia, Kate?
This is just my paranoia. No, I crossed the line between justified fear and paranoia a long time ago.
You know, it's interesting. Keith McHenry, an activist in Food Not Bombs in San Francisco, made similar claims, not so much about window stuff, but phone taps. And he found out when he got papers through discovery process and different lawsuits that he was quite correct. They've been tapping his phone. So if you call Keith McHenry in San Francisco, don't talk about your Coke deals. Go ahead.
Right, yeah. Well, interestingly enough, yes, we did have some proof. We actually took, they had actually planted bugs in my office, if you can believe that. The problem is the bugs were it's something you could get from Ranger Rick magazine, and so there was no way of actually tracing the bug. As far as the taps, since they were all illegal, there was no way of tracing them either. But the person who found the laser surveillance equipment, some $500,000 worth of laser surveillance equipment, had to break into a trailer to get to the equipment. And of course, that trailer was federal property.
Aha.
So as soon as he agreed to testify for me about the surveillance equipment, they swooped down on him, and suddenly he wasn't so willing to testify anymore. So that's what happened there.
Do you think this surveillance continues to the present, or have you become more low profile so that that's no longer the case?
Well, at that time I was also going through a pretty messy divorce, so I kind of left my practice for a year and drove a yellow cab in Santa Cruz, and so yes, I did take a much lower profile. And
mingled with the people as well.
And so after that, things calmed down, but things have heated up again, and I wouldn't be surprised to know that it was back. We just filed a $3.6 million lawsuit against the California Highway Patrol on behalf of several motorcycle riders having to do with the helmet law.
That's you and Renegade Richard Quigley, if I'm not mistaken there. The guy with his beanie on in the Santa Cruz Sentinel.
You got it. You got it. So I wouldn't be surprised if I won't be hearing those clicks and whirs on my phone again real soon. It's not an unusual situation. Plus, I have several lawsuits going against different governmental entities, including the County of Trinity, the County of Shasta, Santa Cruz City, Santa Cruz County. So one of them surely has has decided that it would be interesting to hear what's going on in my off hours.
Well, one of the problems that poor people here in Santa Cruz County have always faced, even when Grinning Ray Grunike was around, civil rights lawyer I was talking about earlier in the show, is that fundamentally there's no legal representation for those seeking, for instance, an injunction against the downtown ordinances, those seeking protection from the sleeping ban. The Santa Cruz City law makes it illegal to sleep at night if you're outside or in a vehicle, and other kinds of abuses, civil rights abuses against the poor. I'd like to get, I've never really talked to you about this. Do you have any, have you been involved in any of this work before you became into the most recent homeless activist movement when I met you? I think it was in the late 80s or early 90s. And throughout the 80s and the 70s, did you have any involvement with poor people and civil rights?
What years were you talking about again? 70s and 80s. 70s and 80s, I was more involved on the outside of the system instead of the inside of the system, which I am now, which is a constant source of consternation for me. I constantly want to go back to being to marching, and instead of handing out my phone number to the marchers so that they can call me when they're arrested. it's difficult having the role of being an officer of the court and being the rebel that I am. So but yeah, back in those days I was more in the streets rather than in the courts. So but I did sue Bank of America for sex discrimination class action and won. Yeah, that was that's going back to the 70s.
Were you in the streets in any homeless causes in the 80s here in Santa Cruz? Have you been in Santa Cruz County for the last, you've been here for the last decade, right? Last two decades?
Yeah, mostly in those days, though, I was working on these Pentagon cases. So I became an expert in that area of the law. That it was pretty esoteric.
But nothing local in terms of local. You weren't out there protesting with Jane Imler or going to the Board of Supervisors and demanding rights for the poor.
Well, I'll tell you what, when I did get involved, it was over the Sandy Loringer event, which rekindled my desire to do some local activism, and at that point I did, in fact, start feeding at the town clock with Jane Imler and set up a table outside of the courthouse to gather signatures on behalf of Sandy Loringer.
Let me review that for those of you who don't know. Sandra Loringer was the second person convicted of serving free food in Santa Cruz County history that I know of. She was convicted in the summer of 1989 after a jury trial in the court of Robert Artichoke Hart Attic, local municipal court judge. And Kate was out in front with her crony, Richard Quigley, Renegade Richard, who apparently she's now representing in some kind of in this beanie case or this CHP abuse case against those who are wearing the wrong kind of motorcycle helmet, and which was featured in a Sentinel story recently. Anyway, Loringer was convicted, and Sandra, you were petitioning outside the county building for her, was it her pardon, or was it simply to hang the judge? I don't recall what the...
We were basically trying to get her out of before her time. I think she got 30 days, which we were successful, I think, in shortening her time by about a week. But one of the most stirring parts of that protest was, if you recall, Robert, at the trial itself, the judge really wanted to give her probation.
Right.
In the worst way, he wanted to give her probation because he knew what kind of negative publicity this was going to bring on Santa Cruz. So he He tried to give her probation, and her question was, Your Honor, does that mean I have to obey all laws? And he, of course, responded yes. And she then responded, if obeying all laws means that I cannot feed my brother when he's hungry, then I am beyond rehabilitation.
It then became a nationwide slogan for a T-shirt. I am beyond rehabilitation. I still have some of those T-shirts manufactured by that ever-present entrepreneur, renegade Richard Quigley, whose name seems to keep popping up again and again. What's happening with renegade Richard Quigley these days?
Well, Richard has pretty much focused his attention on the illegal enforcement of the helmet law at this point, and with the every intention of having the helmet law overturned. In essence, what has happened at this point is that the helmet law has been overturned. It's just that the CHP refuses to recognize that. The law has been gutted by a federal injunction that was issued back in May of 95. In spite of that federal injunction, the CHP has continued to harass particularly Harley-Davidson riders, and it's
we're talking about the California Highway Patrol here?
Yes, we're talking about the California Highway Patrol. It's pretty interesting. We got a hold of through sources that I won't reveal. The Highway Patrol gives a slideshow when they're training their officers as to how to deal with the motorcycle helmet law, and the opening picture of this the slideshow is a cartoon of the most vile looking biker with Born to Lose tattooed on his arm, and just an outrageous picture. I mean, and then they're trying to tell us that they have no in for the bikers. It's pretty ridiculous, but we'll see what happens with that.
Now, where exactly is that case right now? Again, I saw this story. Are you what court are you headed for, and what is your prediction?
We filed the action in federal court at this point, and I think I have some history of having sued the California Highway Patrol in the past, and they have a policy which is pretty much a rampant policy as far as government defendants of refusing to settle for any reason whatsoever. They just will not, even if they're caught with their pants around their ankles, they will not settle a case, partly because they have the resources to wait most plaintiffs out, and they end up papering you to death, and they have unlimited resources to fight you, and of course it's your tax dollar that's going to fight. So they don't. It's no skin off their nose.
You get to pay, in essence, for your own prosecution.
Exactly. So at any rate, they have a policy of not settling. I would be surprised, however, in this case, we really do have them by the proverbials. So I would be surprised if we didn't hear pretty soon some sort of offer to settle. But at this point where we are is the suit was filed a week ago Friday, and the CHP was served last week. So it's just in the absolute primary stages of the lawsuit, and so we'll keep you posted.
So we can't see if there's actually any change in the behavior of CHP personnel toward people on motorcycles, on Harley-Davidsons?
No, not yet. It'll take a while. But I guess I do want to talk a little bit about the helmet law, because I know a lot of people think that the helmet law is a good thing, I guess I want to talk about the larger issue of the erosion, the constant erosion of our civil rights. As far as I'm concerned, what happens and how civil rights become eroded is that the government picks on things that are unpopular in the first place. Smoking, for instance, What else?
Marijuana use.
Jehovah's Witnesses. They pick on the young. They pick on the old. They pick on the helpless. Those who can't fight back. Even the childproof lighters, I think, is probably an example of an erosion of our civil rights because people are. They justify it by saying, "Well, gee, kids burn down houses all the time. What happened to personal responsibility?" Is what I say back to them. But at any rate, the erosion of our rights. If you take their rationale for the helmet law, which is that in fact people are injured because they're not wearing helmets.
What is the helmet law for those who don't know?
The helmet law basically says that a motorcycle rider has to wear a DOT approved helmet before he can Department of Transportation approved helmet before he can he or she can ride on the streets of the state of California. And again, the rationale was that there were so many injuries because of not wearing helmets. There are two or three things that you need to know. First of all, what they don't have are the statistics on how many people are injured because they wear helmets. The two things you have on a motorcycle that are different from a car would be your vision and your hearing, and of course the helmet impairs both. Not to mention the fact that your body wasn't built for taking a hit on your head. In other words, the helmet bounces, and so that causes a lot of spinal injuries. But even regardless of all of that, the rationale is that since certain people are injured and that becomes a burden on society, that they have the right to regulate it up front so that we avoid these injuries. Now, if you take this to its ultimate extreme, which you know, it's not that outrageous to think that it might happen, then they can rationalize maybe telling you have to wear a helmet inside your car, because of course that would make it safer, just one step further. Or maybe armor as you walk down the street. I mean, it's a possibility, I guess, that somebody's arm could flip out and hurt you. Or the ultimate, maybe the food cops who would stand in front of the supermarket and go over your food and say, no, you got to take those Twinkies back because you might get diabetes or heart disease. All of these things cause a burden on society. So that rationale, if you carry it all the way to its ultimate absurdity,